And welcome back to The Blank Canvas, the show in which we speak about visual culture and creative community. I'm Amanda Coulson. I'm the director of the National Art Gallery of the Bahamas, and you're listening to 96.9 Guardian Talk Radio. Don't forget, we've also got a Facebook page, which is facebook.com/NAGBlankCanvas, and there are pictures of who's on the show, and you can leave comments and thumbs up and things like that. Although I do think we're going to merge our Blank Canvas Facebook page with our NAGB Facebook page because it's just getting too complicated. But anyhow, for the time being, it's there. But you should also go to our NAGB Facebook page and just see, because we post all the news from the gallery and funny pictures of silly things we're doing, and it's nice. So go there and thumbs up us and tell all your friends. We're going to talk now a little bit to Leanne Russell, who came in from Abaco this morning, and the plane was late, but that's okay. You know, which is actually one of the issues, really, of being, you know, a national art gallery and trying to serve this archipelago, which I can never say, is this difficulty in connection. And I know, Leanne, every time we've invited you or we've tried to do things, there's always some drama with the
logistical breakdown.
Yeah, exactly. The crate doesn't fit in the plane. Or, you know, like they say it will, but it doesn't. And then,
shipping companies leaving things and flights delayed.
I mean, how hard is it to be a practicing artist in Abaco?
It's very difficult. Mm-hmm. It's one of the things that I battle most. And I would love to be here. I always talk, you know, the art scene in Nassau right now is just such an amazing thing. I love coming here and just the community, sitting down and just the dialogue that I have. I go back and I'm so inspired, but in the same token, it's kind of depressing going back to Abaco and not having that community and being once removed from it and having to fly here to take part in things. So, you know, I'd love to see ways that we can bridge those gaps.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we're trying. We've done a few shows on other family islands, and I think we're going to actually try to come to Abaco this year. And bring part of the collection, and you know, we reach out to schools and all the rest of it. But you know, it's a production, because again, as soon as you're involving a boat or a plane, it's just so, you know, like when I used to live in Europe or in the States, you know, just throw everything in the back of a truck, and you just drive, and it's not that complicated. But here again, you know, you're shipping things, and then other people are going to handle them, because that's you know, if you put stuff on a truck, you can wrap it and you can, you know, take care of it, and you can pack the truck how you want it to be, and you know, but you know, when you're sending stuff in a crate or on a boat or in a plane, you know, other people are handling that stuff, and 99 times out of 100 they don't really understand how to handle what it is you're shipping, so it creates problems, and it's expensive, as you know, right?
Oh yeah,
you know,
not only time investment, but monetary investment, being on the out islands and having to ship and fly in, you know, it's you spoke about taking on the title and the weight of saying, I am an artist, I'm a practicing artist. That goes along with it. Mm-hmm. You know, people don't understand that it's a commitment, not just with time, but with your money as well and how you prioritize. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a huge responsibility.
Yeah, no, definitely. And how does the do you feel support from your own community? Do people just think you're like weird for doing that, or do they are they kind of admire? Are they like, oh my gosh, you know, she's in the National Art Gallery show, and like, oh, Abaco, you know? Because we're so happy. There's actually a lot of artists from various out islands in the National Exhibition this year.
There's more so this year
because you know, again, we've made that effort to be in touch and communicate and post things online and allow access in a way. But is the community? Do they think you're
it's
awesome
funny,
like we do?
It's funny that you say that, because I didn't think that. You know, some people just wouldn't get it, you know, and I had a conversation with somebody before the show, and they're like, but why are you doing it? I'm like, what do you mean, why? Like, but why? Like, why do you do this? Like, why are you spending this money to go? Why are you investing all of this money in constructing this piece? And I was like, because I kind of have to, like, you know, if you're an artist, you have to create, and to be accepted to a show of this caliber at the National Art Gallery, I see that as such a blessing. But yeah, no, a lot of people don't get it. A lot of people are like, well, you know, you can buy so many other things with this money that you're doing this piece.
Well, I was going to say, it's funny, we understand commercial, like if someone went out and bought a, you know, $800 handbag, nobody would probably... They'd probably,
and I always,
you know, say anything.
I always
like, oh,
get
wow,
that
a nice
question.
Handbag, you know,
I always get that question. They're like, well, are you going to sell your piece? Mm-hmm. Say, well, it's not that kind of piece. It's not that kind of art. Yeah. Yeah. You know, everything is commoditized to the point that if you can't put a dollar value on it, a lot of people don't see the value at all.
Well, so. And actually, outside of our country, your work could probably be monetized because there are collections and people that are interested in having work like that. So that's also just a question of, you know, our own sort of development as a commercial market and what people want to live with right now. The piece you've done, actually, I think one of the first pieces I saw from you, and it was actually in the Central Bank competition, and it was maybe like 4 years ago or... It's probably about 4.5 years ago. I've been here 5 years, and it was like this kind of poinciana tree.
With the church window.
Yeah, and on wood again, which I thought was really interesting. And I remember we talked a lot about that painting. And I find that really interesting that you, you know, you do paint, but very often your work is on wood, and it seems like you really love the texture of the wood.
Reclaim.
And
a lot of
So I thought that was kind
materials.
Of interesting also between you and Margot. I mean, it's a totally different approach because you're not like, you know, a carpenter per se, but you have this, you know, something about the wood really attracts you. Mm-hmm. What is that?
I grew up with a father who was jack of all trades. I grew up with grandparents and great-grandparents and... you know, five generations in one house. Mm-hmm. And they were people who, they were upcycling before upcycling was a thing.
Yeah.
You know, nothing went to waste. Mm-hmm.
Wood, repurposing.
Wood was being...
By necessity.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Wood was being refurbished and, you know, remade into other things. Mm-hmm. And to me, that always was very interesting growing up, seeing that... you know, this palette is now a table or an island in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, growing up and collecting driftwood on the beach and things like that, and then seeing them plane it down and seeing, you know... A whole new thing emerging out of this wood. It was almost like opening a present to my great-grandfather when he planed it down to see what kind of wood it was, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So, that's cool. Things like that always intrigued me. I find a lot of beauty in, like, reclaimed shutters and reclaimed wood and things like that.
I remember
the
piece you did for The Last Innie, which was that sort of wonderful cabinet with a mermaid inside. And again, there was so much texture to it and so much history. And the piece you have on show now is a really interesting piece because, again, it's like, you know, basically a wooden structure. But it's made like one of those kids' books that you can get when you, like, there's animals inside and you can, like, turn like a third of the page and give, like, the lion, like, a monkey's body or whatever. And you kind of make these.
That's exactly what it is.
You know, I got kids, so, you know, I recognize that right away. Yeah. You're actually using people. And the name of the piece is Muddle and Match, Moral Luck. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting because each page, when it's as it quote unquote should be, is there's three. And one is a woman. And one is a man. And they've got legs and... their bits and pieces. The man is like Leonardo's man. He's actually nude. So you can definitely see he's a man. And then there's a person who is a mermaid, actually. She's a female mermaid. So but then you can flip through them and you can make different people. So you can have a woman who's got breasts, or a person who has a human who has breasts but has male genitalia. Mm-hmm. You could have a man with a mermaid's fin, but a male chest, and so you can make all these different kind of people. And there's text that go along with them too. And as you can turn the pages, the text will also change. But so they say things like Chantal at Sugar Apple Gannep doesn't need a man is the middle section because parentheses black. Close parentheses, women is demule of the world. And then there's another one. Rashad's main weapon is his pain. He lives in fear of seeming weak because baddie boys get shot. And as you turn the pages, they come up with like sort of different stories as well. So obviously you're speaking to gender assignment issues of, you know, what people have to deal with, and not only, and I think this is where the conversation always gets very difficult, is, you know, it's not only people who identify as queer that feel unwanted or they don't fit into a community. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, even you know, after what happened with the referendum, there's a lot of women that just feel like they're not valued. And I think there are a lot of men that just, because they don't want to go play sports or something, also feel not valued.
Of course.
And very often people then assign something to that. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, Zizzy or Ed or whatever. And that's actually not generally the case. But I think there is, and it seems like a lot of the work in the show was about this feeling of alienation. Mm-hmm. So what sort of impelled you to make that piece, which was going to be like a very strong statement about a lot of things that happened in the country in the last couple of years?
It kind of goes back to what you brought up about Margot's piece as well, about we are assigned these roles, mm-hmm. and we get locked into these roles and get locked into these narratives. And it almost becomes very stereotypical that from the outside looking in, we can't assess someone else's situation because we are constantly looking at it from whatever our seat of privilege is or whatever mm-hmm. our biases are. And so, you know, people who may be closeted have this very stereotypical narrative surrounding them. The transgender community right now, there's a very stereotypical bohemian narrative surrounding them. Female gender issues. It was actually a set of 8 characters initially. Mm-hmm. And just like Margot said, you kind of edit down and mm-hmm. say what's feasible to do mm-hmm. and what works best for the mm-hmm. piece. Mm-hmm. So it's cut down to 4 characters. There's actually a character in the beginning. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was edited down to the 4 characters, and the stance of moral luck comes in just to say that things that we look at as arbitrary, like mm-hmm. Where you're from, mm-hmm. Gender, sexuality, mm-hmm. we almost say that these things are arbitrary in assessing morality mm-hmm. and things like that. Mm-hmm. When you start flipping mm-hmm. through and changing the narrative, you realize that mm-hmm. they're huge and mm-hmm. in determining like someone's where they're at in their life mm-hmm. or, you know, what their moral standing is. Mm-hmm. So,
or, you know, how the community perceives their moral standing or whatever. Yeah, yeah. I got told the other day that I was a half breed. because someone said, I wouldn't come to your country. And I said, well, actually, just I need to stop you there. This is my country. Yeah. So, you know, my people have been here since 1789. And the person said, well, then you must be a half-breed.
Wow.
So I know. I was like, oh, okay. But again, like, it's a lot to do with, you know, expectations mm-hmm. of how people should look or be or sound mm-hmm. or whatever. And when they come up with something that is not that expectation, it's surprising and shocking somehow, mm-hmm. right? And well, and this assignation of what a role should be.
Exactly. And I wanted the interchangeability of the narratives to show mm-hmm. that there are threads of commonality in each one of these characters, you know, quote unquote, the Bahamian characters, you know, marginalized groups don't exist in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. All of our stories are kind of interconnected.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a feeder effect. Mm-hmm. You know, we all affect each other's stories. There's a thread. The middle page of your story might mm-hmm. be the first page of my story. You know,
it's kind of interesting that the audience can change the story, right?
So
it's not just the piece is there and mm-hmm. you've assigned these. I mean, you've created these characters, but then the community around the characters can have this effect on them, mm-hmm. right? And I think that's a really interesting part of the piece, is that it's not kind of complete without interaction,
and that's how I wanted it to be. And I wanted it to be, you know, you can go back to the gallery. We want people to go to the show multiple times. Mm-hmm. You see something different every time. And the idea fascinated me that, you know, someone can come and see the show 4 different times, and each time they come, the piece would look different.
Yeah.
The story would be different. They're going to take something different away.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And there's actually, I really do hope that people do come more than once. And I always tell everyone on the show, don't forget it's always free on Sunday, because there's no, and the reason we did that was specifically for that, because I think very often people will be like, oh, well, I, you know, paid my $5 and I got to see everything now. And that can be quite, you know, imposing. Like, you're like, oh my gosh, I've got to see like 80 artworks. And, mm-hmm. you know, so actually, you know, you could really come. I mean, the show's up for 3 months. You could come, you know, every other Sunday and just see 4 works, you know, and spend really time with those works, and it wouldn't cost anything and it wouldn't be any additional burden. So I really encourage people to do that, to come back and see the show on several occasions, because there are, again, over 50 artists in the show, and they're all really interesting works. And every time you look at the show, I gave a tour yesterday, you start seeing different connections as well. You're like, oh, hey, this one like works with that one. And, you know, again, like, say, so you go back and you start to see different stories. So we're going to take another very short break, and then we'll come back and we'll just, you know, join in both ladies together, all three of us, to just, you know, speak to the show. And again, all these themes that are coming out of the show, and what as artists, you know, we can do to engender that kind of dialogue that we think will sort of move the country forward. So you're listening to The Blank Canvas, the show in which we speak about visual culture and creative community. I'm Amanda Coulson. I'm the director of the National Art Gallery, and you're listening to 96.9 Guardian Talk Radio. We're going to be right back after this break.